Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be revisiting CoreOS. A lot has happened in 2.5 years, so we're going to check it all out. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 397, recorded July 19th, 2016. CoreOS Update. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device, which is one integration. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz. Merlin at Stunninge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be well aware of and want to know what's changed in the last 2.5 years, like today's show, or projects that you don't even know anything about at all and want to download right after this episode and go play with it. Joining me today is Jonathan Bennett, who's been on a couple of shows previously, but he's back again as my co-host. Welcome back.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Good, good, good. And where are you speaking to us from?
I am once again in the home office in Lawton, Oklahoma.
Cool, cool. And I, some people may recognize this background. This is the 11th floor of a building in Santa Monica. I am at ZipRecruiter headquarters. That's what I was trying to say. I tried to do that all at once, though. And it's a nice sunny day out there, expected high about 85. So it's, I'm wearing a short sleeve shirt today again because otherwise it gets a little too worn out. So today, as I mentioned sort of in the opening, we have a return guest. CoreOS was on, let me see where my notes say that, was on back around episode 314 in October of 2014, and it was still kind of an infant project at that time. Okay, apparently they let anybody do this show. All right, infant project at that time. And but it's come a long way since then. I bumped into the representatives over at Red Hat Summit a few weeks back, and I thought, has it changed enough? Oh, yeah, it's changed a lot, especially in a couple years. So we are going to bring back Brandon Phillips, who talked to us at that point about how CoreOS had developed so far, and there's a lot more to talk about. So CoreOS is a... is one of these things. It's all about containers, all about running thin and for servers, running in a way that you don't deploy the whole VM every time you want to deploy a new application. You simply have this thin the OS, and on top of it sits these containers, and they share resources in a much easier way. What do you know about this, Jonathan?
Well, I did take some time and review the show from a couple of years ago, and did a little bit of reading on their website. And it looks really interesting. It honestly reminds me of OpenWrite, interestingly enough. And, of course, that's the little minimal Linux installation that goes on routers. And the reason it reminded me of it is because they face some of the same challenges, and that is how can we take the huge Linux infrastructure and distill it down to here's the little bit that we absolutely have to have and ship just that and then put things on top of it. So it'll be interesting.
I was trying to figure out what you meant when you said OpenWrite. I know that is OpenWRT, so I'm trying to figure out OpenWrite. Is that some sort of a script thingy? Is it? No, okay, great. Well, that's pretty good. And I'm not much of a Linux guy, as most of my audience know, so I'm more of a FreeBSD side guy. So hopefully you know a little bit more about Linux, can ask some of the heavier Linux questions, and most of this will make more sense to you. So it's a good thing you're on the show today. So, but before we bring on our guest... before we bring on a guest, I have a very important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it will be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay, or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily, too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes along, all you'll have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying one step ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. So there are simple and secure payments code you can integrate quickly. The Braintree code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients, and SDKs in 7 languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. Elegant code with clear documentation. So Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payments types with one integration. Integrating it into your app is as easy as inserting a few lines of code. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/floss. And we thank Braintree for supporting Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Brandon, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
Our headquarters in San Francisco.
Cool. So again, we've had a show on CoreOS before, but let's start from scratch. Let's imagine people haven't heard of this at all. How is my quick explanation, and what problem is this actually solving?
Sure. So the problem that we're trying to solve primarily is the problem of how do people deploy and manage large application infrastructure. And when you think of large application infrastructure, this can be like websites, this can be APIs that power mobile applications, this can be backend services that IT teams run, and that sort of thing. Now, we kind of, the style of how we think about managing these sorts of compute services is what we like to call GIFI, which is Google's infrastructure for everyone else. And what we're trying to do is bring kind of the secret sauce that companies like Google and Twitter and Facebook have used internally in order to manage their compute infrastructure, all their servers and storage, et cetera, and bring those technologies and that method of building out applications and infrastructure to other companies and organizations throughout the world through open source software and products.
Well, you know, it's interesting because even at the scale of my smaller client, Insight Cruises, there's still a problem of having like a couple of web servers, a big, powerful database engine, and things like mail services and things like that. And we're actually moving towards using containers and things like that because it just does make things a whole lot simpler. It also means we can do our development locally on our laptops, and we know we have pretty much the same code going on. But my other big client, ZipRecruiter, of course, has dozens of machines, and mostly in AWS. EC2, and they're looking at the kind of solutions it would take to move towards something like Docker and things like that. So this is definitely a hot topic these days, and it's come quite a ways in the last few years. Can you kind of tell us how the lay of the land has moved forward?
For sure. So when we last spoke, we were very early on in the whole ecosystem. CoreOS is a company. And the namesake of the company is the first product that we built called CoreOS Linux. And like you said, CoreOS Linux is this minimal operating system designed to run containers primarily. Now, that's one piece of the puzzle. This is a piece of the puzzle that we're really passionate about. And we started at the lowest level because we felt that that was the part of the infrastructure that needed to be tackled and that we would move up the stack over time. And so what's happened over the last 2.5 years is a lot of new open source technologies have been built. And the technologies have gotten quite robust and featureful over that time period, to the point that we're seeing a lot of deployments of some of the core technologies that we're building through a lot of companies all over the world. So what's changed is essentially the technologies have started to move into production, and the technologies through collaboration of a bunch of different companies have gotten to the point where they actually feel fun to use. There's always this like point in technology where early on it's kind of, you're writing the compiler, the low-level details are kind of complex, and then you get to this point where you have like the interactive prompt on a Python or Perl command line where it's actually becoming fun, and you can it's almost like you can like playing music, you can kind of play around with it and be creative. And so these technologies around containers and infrastructure are getting to that point where you can kind of be creative with them.
Okay. And so the containers then, as I said in the opening of the show, the containers sort of allow you to separate some of your concerns. In other words, you can have it so that somebody, say, if you had both a database and a web server on the same machine, there might be some attack vectors and things. So this helps with security, right?
Yeah. So to break down the sort of technology, what's going on is that up until now, before containers, what a lot of people would do is they'd use configuration management or their package management systems, and they would spend weeks on end trying to figure out how to build and deploy and then actually run their application on the servers that they purchased from Amazon or that they've racked into their own data centers. And so one of the complexities there is that you have to spend some time thinking about, well, what happens if that version of Python that I'm running my application on today, I actually need to update it. Well, now I have to, say, double my compute resources because, the application today is using Python 2.6. I want to update to Python 2.7 or Python 3. And now I have these two sort of different environments. And this causes complexity for the operations team, and it causes complexity for the engineers not knowing what environment the code's going to land in. So the interesting thing about containers is that you can put them onto a machine and remove them. You can run multiple containers side by side that are in completely isolated environments. And so it allows you to push consistency from, like you said, your developer's laptop and have that same environment that was on the developer's laptop actually appear on the server. And it's not just sort of how we've been thinking about VMs, where like I spin up the same VM that's on my laptop in production. It's I'm actually running the process on my laptop, say this Python process, and that Python process is fully isolated on my laptop. And then when I push it into production, it's isolated in that same way on the VM. But it's not using a heavyweight, not using the heavyweight technologies of virtual machines. They're actually just regular Linux processes on the servers.
And one of the problems that I'm seeing here at ZipRecruiter is because we're still sort of more traditional methods is that we would have basically a configuration management tool, like say Puppet or Chef or something, and we'd have to run that separately on my laptop in dev, in QA, and then separately on each machine in production. So we end up taking a lot of time to do a rollover for the 8 web servers because we could only take out a few of them at a time and then run the configuration tool and then put it back up. How does using containers simplify that process?
For sure. So like you said, one of the major places containers are getting used initially is just kind of simplifying this rollout. And so today what happens is you'll have one machine. That machine's dedicated to being a web node of some sort. So it's running the actual application code on that machine. And then you'll take it out of the load balancer, that entire machine out of the load balancer. Generally, I'm generalizing. You take that machine out of the load balancer, and then you deploy the new version of the application on that machine, and then you put it back in the load balancer. Now, the interesting thing about containers and the technologies that are being built around it is that you can actually run the old version of the application and the new version of the application right next to each other. And you can start to do interesting things like say, we'll route 10% of the traffic to the new version of the application. And they're running side by side on the same host. So you're never having to like take an entire chunk of your infrastructure out of rotation. You kind of bleed over the traffic from one instance to another. And you run those instances side by side on the same physical or virtual machine.
Okay, and so what's tell me some of the new projects that have been brought onto the CoreOS sort of infrastructure team since a couple years from now. I saw a bunch of new names like, there's improvements to etcd. You want to start by talking about that?
Sure. So early on when we started CoreOS, one of the things that we're really passionate about is how to service and update servers. So one of the like sort of status quo things about the entire industry is that you install something on a server and then you don't touch it. Obviously, this is a bit of a problem because as we know, every day new vulnerabilities are coming out, new zero-day vulnerabilities, and you need to be cycling and keeping those servers up to date over time. So in order to actually service updates to a machine, it'd be very, very nice if it was automatic, so system administrators don't think about it. Now, the automatic updates in CoreOS Linux are optional. You can opt out of it or pause it as you wish. But we wanted those updates to be able to be serviced automatically for people who want to not think about this problem of how do I keep the underlying server infrastructure up to date. And so we built this thing called etcd, which is a key value store that works kind of like computers acting out democracy. So you run multiple copies of etcd. They all have a copy of the current decisions that are being made. And then through a voting process, when somebody submits a change into the etcd database, they decide on the new state of it, whether they're going to accept that right or not. And once the write has been accepted, it's replicated to all the machines in the cluster. And what we use this for is coordination of the cluster, say knowing where processes are in the cluster, or in the case really early on with CoreOS Linux, actually deciding whether an individual machine can reboot to apply updates to say its kernel. And so over the last 2 years since we last spoke, etcd has found itself in a ton of large production infrastructure. And one of the biggest projects that it has adopted etcd is this project called Kubernetes, which is a project introduced by Google that has a ton of different open source collaborators. We're huge collaborators. There's a bunch of other companies working on it besides just Google now. But Kubernetes is an open source version of Google's Borg, which is kind of the secret sauce that they've been using to run their servers over the last 10 years. And through this open source project, they selected etcd as the primary data store. And so over those last 2 years, we've been doing really a ton of engineering to ensure that etcd is very resilient to failures, whether that's machine failures, kernel failures, network failures. In fact, one of the engineers found and fixed a bug in TempFS. We found that there's an off by one error in the page handling of TempFS in the Linux kernel. So the database has done a lot of really robust testing, because this is the kind of cornerstone, the foundational piece of a lot of these systems. And etcd has kind of found itself as kind of the de facto standard of these what are called consensus data stores.
Cool. And what's Canal?
Canal, so in Kubernetes, you have the idea of the control machines, and these control machines are essentially the managers. So you may have one or five control machines, and then you have dozens or hundreds or one worker machine that's actually running the application workload. And then on each of those worker machines, you have one or more containers, and each of those containers has an IP address. So you can put them behind load balancers. You can log into them. You can hit them with curl from your workstation, that sort of thing. And so one of the challenges is that in a lot of environments, setting up multiple IP addresses per host can be a little tricky. So we provide a number of different options through this project called Canal, say to generate a overlay network so that all these machines can talk to each other, or to talk to your existing routing infrastructure to do BGP announcements of, hey, this machine's currently running a container on this IP address and it needs to talk to this IP address. And we can start to do stuff like enforcement. So you can say, my front-end application needs to talk to the database, but it's only going to be making ingress connections. The application's only going to be talking to the database. The database shouldn't be talking to the application. And so Canal has this enforcement policy to it as well. So you can start to do what network administrators have always wanted to do. The application developers are incentivized to mark up their application for service discovery reasons to say, my app needs to talk to the database. And then network administrators can start to do things like say, well, I want to enforce that only the application can only talk to the database. It can't talk to anything else within the environment. So it's a nice situation where the developers and the administrators who care about security are actually kind of working together. And so Canal is a collection of tooling to kind of bring what we like to call this Giphy infrastructure to networking infrastructure.
All right. Hey, I wanted to jump in for a minute and ask a question.
Sure.
CoreOS, the operating system itself, is it a downstream? Is it a derivative from something like, I know lots of things are Debian derivatives, or is it kind of homegrown?
Yeah. So CoreOS Linux started, we needed some build tools when we started the project 3 years ago. And so we actually forked from Chrome OS, which is system that runs on like the Chromebooks or in a lot of these Chrome boxes that people do Google Hangouts on. And so we forked that SDK, and that SDK internally uses Portage, which is the build system of Gentoo. So we don't ship, none of this is actually apparent to the person using CoreOS Linux that we use the Portage build system. But CoreOS Linux, that's what we use. Is it really doesn't have a package manager. We use containers for essentially everything. If you SSH into the machine and you want to install TCP dump, you can enter a container that's got your Debian user space or your Fedora user space, whatever you're comfortable with, and you can install whatever debugging tools. You can install Emacs. You can install Wireshark if you want. And so we rely on containers to do administrative work and then also to run the applications. So really, you can think of CoreOS Linux as providing just the very basics of what you need to get a Linux host up and running. So we do things like service the kernel. We use a pure Linux upstream kernel from kernel.org. Once the first stable release comes out, then we release a new version of CoreOS Linux. We provide SSHD and then some additional stuff around setting up networks and remote disk drives, say like iSCSI and that sort of thing. So we provide essentially like the firmware layer, and then the applications, whether that's, you know, the tooling that you want as a system administrator to debug your systems or the actual applications you're running, come on top in the form of containers. We kind of think of containers as the new way of doing package management that solves a lot of the problems that traditional package management have of, well, what does Python mean when I have Python 2.7 and 2.6 and 3.0? Which version of Python am I actually getting? And there's a lot that falls out from that.
Okay, we've actually got a couple of questions here from the chat room.
Sure.
One person wants to know, is there a good how-to or a good beginner project for someone that's just beginning with CoreOS? A good way to sink our teeth into it?
For sure. The main thing that I think, sort of the end API that we've been shooting for over the last couple of years has been the Kubernetes API. So there's a couple of ways to start playing with the Kubernetes API. We have some getting started guides on coreos.com/docs. If you just search on that page for Kubernetes, you'll find a single machine Kubernetes setup. You can set it up under Vagrant if you have Vagrant installed. Another way of starting to play with Kubernetes is through a tool called Minikube. That we've been contributing to. That tool is a little bit less battle-hardened than the Vagrant, but our hopes is to make essentially a single binary that you can download and try out Kubernetes and try out a virtual machine that's using all these technologies on your laptop. So, I think the best place would be to try to get Kubernetes up and running on top of CoreOS through those Vagrant guides, deploy your first application, and sort of play with the system and getting an understanding of how the whole thing works.
Okay, another question from the chat room, which I'm going to expand upon a bit. CJ asks, will CoreOS run on a Raspberry Pi? And I'll expand that a bit. Do you have ARM support?
Sure. So, unfortunately, CoreOS will not run on a Raspberry Pi, but we do have ARM64 support. So we have... The problem is that ARM32 is kind of a difficult platform to get working, particularly for some technical details around a lot of the technologies that are used in Kubernetes, et cetera, which is Go. And Go doesn't play well with 32-bit architectures. But if you have an ARM64 machine, which are becoming more and more common, you can boot CoreOS Linux. And we emailed out to the CoreOS development mailing list a few weeks ago about the builds that are coming out of our build system for that.
All right, so we hang on and cross our fingers, and maybe eventually we'll get it on Raspberry Pi 3, since it's technically
sure.
A 64-bit processor. So tell us a little bit about security updates. There were a couple of questions in chat about this, and I remember this being a topic that was raised in the last interview. So... do I have to go and say, well, okay, there's a new kernel. Let me go and grab the new kernel for CoreOS. How does that work?
Yeah, so very much like our phones, CoreOS by default, again, this can be managed and disabled, will grab new updates, apply them, and based on policy, apply those updates by rebooting itself. So the way that CoreOS works in a technical way is different than a lot of traditional Linux packet or a Linux operating system. So CoreOS at any given time has an A and a B copy of itself. So you may be running the A version of CoreOS on your machine, while that copy is running, it goes and figures out there's a new version of CoreOS Linux available. It'll download that to the B file system. And then once it's coordinated with the rest of the cluster, or maybe you just say, I don't care, and it reboots itself because you don't have any coordination, it will come onto the B partition and start to run that. Now, the nice thing here is that the user, let's say that B update is bad or something has happened to it, CoreOS has a bunch of systems, safety systems in place that it can automatically roll back to the A partition if something has gone wrong. And so what CoreOS does for all those base kind of firmware level things that CoreOS Linux provides, like the kernel and SSHD, et cetera, we provide automatic updates on that layer. Now, the other piece of it is obviously the applications running on top of that CoreOS Linux instance. And for those, containers kind of give a nice, consistent way of deploying new software. And we have a number of tools that we built for containers in order for system administrators to introspect those containers to figure out what they're running, in order to manage through things like Kubernetes updates to those containers so they can say, a new vulnerability came out in OpenSSL. We have this deployed in production. We need to deploy a version of the application that doesn't have this vulnerability. We need to roll the load balancers over to that new version of the application and then remove all of the known vulnerable copies of our application running in containers out of the infrastructure. And so Kubernetes provides that sort of level of API of being able to really confidently introspect the infrastructure, figure out what containers are running, and roll over and put new versions of the application in production. And then through open source projects and products like our Quay product at quay.io, what we do is we actually look through those containers that you've built. So say you have a container with Java or OpenSSL or something in it. We will look through that container and say, well, what versions of software are in these containers? And we can notify you through email or through other notifications to say, well, this container that you have that is on your account has XYZ vulnerability. And we do this as a continuous scan, essentially very similar to those security agents that you may be running on your host live, only this is sort of done statically. So it's introspecting and looking through all of the copies of software that you may have deployed in your infrastructure. And so that's through an open source project we have called Claire, and through our product, a hosted product called Quay.io. Quay.io.
Okay, let me make sure I understand this. So, using these projects, it doesn't matter what containered process I'm running, it will go through, and even the ones that until you ran it, it knew nothing about it, it'll go through and scan and alert and say, "Hey, you've got this out of date piece of software. You should go update it." Is that how that works?
Yeah, so why don't we walk through how a container actually gets built. So a container, generally today, what happens is that somebody will say, I need Java, I need some other things inside of my container, and then I'll put in the jar file or the WAR files or whatever else I need to actually run the application. And so what they'll do is they'll have this Docker file that describes what goes into the container. And they'll usually start from some existing user space operating system like Debian or Fedora or something. So they'll apt-get install Java, and then they'll copy their actual application logic on top of that. And so what they do is they create essentially like a trut, so a root file system that has everything that is needed to support this Java process. And then that gets uploaded to a registry after they build it. One of the registry we provide is called Quay. And in that registry, we have all the metadata that we need to tell you, well, when you built this image, the Java that you built was up to date, but now today a new vulnerability in Java came out. And so we can notify you, hey, this thing that you've uploaded to us, it actually has vulnerabilities. You need to go check your infrastructure to see if you're running a copy of it anywhere. And if so, build a new version of the container and deploy that.
Wow, that's really impressive. There's a lot of really cool features with CoreOS, but that to me is kind of a killer feature. That's really impressive. So we're talking a little bit about security, and there is something that I've wondered about containers for a while, and that is this idea of a container versus a VM. And virtual machines have been around for a while, and there's this concept of encapsulation that even if the things running inside a virtual machine get compromised, there isn't any way, or there shouldn't be any way, for the compromised system to break out of the VM and try to attack the mother computer, the VM host. Do containers work the same way? Has that been tested as well as VM? And then does CoreOS have anything in place that gives even more protection against that kind of a breakout attack?
For sure. So VMs do provide a very solid level of protection, and this level of protection, for the most part, is sort of guaranteed at the hardware layer. Of course, there have been all sorts of examples where VMs have been able to break out of their even VM jail and affect the host operating system. Famously, this has happened to public cloud providers, and I'm sure that all of us have had to update our VM infrastructure at some time to fix these sorts of issues. Now, in the world of containers, I think that the state is improving. It's not as locked down as virtual machines. This is because containers are really just regular Unix processes running on top of a shared kernel. And so essentially, unless you would trust an application to run on top of a shared kernel today, you probably shouldn't be using containers from different sources, from different trust domains on the same virtual machine or on the same physical hardware. Now, the reality is, for a lot of us, the applications that we're deploying a bunch of applications that are we're running in-house from people that we trust. We're deploying applications from folks that are on our development teams or from trusted ISVs. And so this is less of a concern because we sort of implicitly trust the software that we're deploying together. And there's all sorts of tooling in the container ecosystem around making it easy for you to say, this machine should only run workloads that are tagged in this way, and this machine should only run workloads that are tagged in this way. So if you do have concerns about two sort of workloads running next to each other, you can isolate them in that way. There are also tricks you can do. So we have a container runtime called Rocket. And what Rocket can do optionally is it can take your container and wrap it inside of a VM. And this is a really, really lightweight VM that we've been working with folks at Intel on. And so the VM boots about 500 milliseconds. We're talking about half a second to boot. And it uses a bunch of tricks in order to be very, very lightweight on resources. And then it runs your container inside. So for a performance penalty of 10-20%, you can, if you're paranoid of that container image being ran on a shared kernel, you can actually wrap it in a full virtual machine with Rocket and what we call the LKVM stage one. Intel brands it as Clear Containers, and it's a technology that they've been working on. But that is an option, and it adds a little bit of complexity. It's harder to debug, obviously, because it's a virtual machine. So instead of running strace directly on the container process, you have to enter the virtual machine and that sort of thing. But it does provide the same guarantees, if you need them, as virtual machines that you rely on today.
Okay, that's some great technology. Does Rocket work on AMD chips as well as Intel? Because I heard you say that you're working with Intel on this technology. If I've got an AMD chip on my server, which I do, can I run Rocket? Will it work?
Yeah, for sure. So the technology just takes advantage of normal extensions to the ironically called AMD 64 extensions to the x86 architecture. So if you have any 64-bit x86 processor with virtual machine extensions, you can use the Rocket LKVM technology today.
I presume then that we mentioned Docker a number of times. So I presume Docker is a fundamental part of the whole CoreOS concept, right?
Yeah, really the fundamental part of the concept is containers. We have we have customers who use the Docker engine. We have customers who use Rocket, which is a container engine we've introduced. We have customers using even lighter weight things like InSpawn and that sort of stuff. So there's really two things. There's the Docker image, and the Docker image has, for the most part, been the most popular image format out there. And so technologies like Rocket and the Docker engine can run the image, the Docker image today. The Docker engine is a piece of technology that actually executes and isolates the container in a variety of ways. And people have, for example, with Rocket or for lots of other technologies, they've been running Docker images without the Docker engine. So I think really the key pieces of technology for CoreOS are the Docker image and the kind of ecosystem that's come out of that. And that's something, the Docker image, that's being standardized through an effort that we've been involved in called the Open Container Initiative. And then the actual containerization technology that allows you to run all these processes next to each other in a nice, consistent manner and be able to swap them out and that sort of thing. So those are really the pieces of enabling technology that emerged really early on to make things like CoreOS possible.
And this Quay thing you were talking about before, Key Quay, how it's pronounced, but is that like a Docker repository, or is it something different?
Yeah, so Quay is a, at its heart, what is known as a Docker registry or container registry. And what it holds on to are Docker images and a couple other formats, app container images, which is a format we worked on with Red Hat and Google and some other folks. And then in the near future here, we'll be holding on to open container images, which are another image format. And kind of our hope with open container is that open container supersedes all the other formats that have come before it. And it sort of is a way for the container industry to avoid the mistakes that were made in the Linux package management industry, where we have all these people spending so much time and effort packaging something for Deb and then packaging it again for RPM and then packaging it again for whatever it is. And so that Open Container Initiative has folks involved from Google and Red Hat and Docker and ourselves and tons of other folks like from Microsoft, et cetera.
Now, my preferred desktop is OS X. Of course, I've just freaked out a bunch of other people that listen to the show, but hey, we know this. I've said this before. Am I stuck not being able to use any of this? Do I have to run first a full VM and then run CoreOS on top of that? Or where do I go to kind of be able to do work on my laptop?
Yeah, containers are very much a Linux-focused technology, and so there's all sorts of tooling that makes it nicer to run on your laptop. So I worked to add some support for OS X in the project called Minikube, which allows you pretty transparently to you don't know you're using a VM, but allows you to spin up a Kubernetes cluster. We have things like the Vagrant stuff from CoreOS, so you're able to use a Vagrant machine to test out all these technologies, and it's pretty transparent. All these technologies like Kubernetes run over RPC systems and are designed for you as a system administrator at your laptop to administer one or more hosts out in your infrastructure. So it's pretty natural to emulate that experience by running a VM on your laptop.
Okay, and I'm still pretty new to the whole container area. How do I develop with this? Do I run my Docker build and get an image that then gets launched, but how do I change files while it's running to make sure that, you know, as I'm tweaking and making this HTML file look different or whatever, where does that live?
For sure. The development experience around containers is still sort of developing. So one of the things is people do use this Docker build cycle as kind of an iterative cycle. The latency of that can be a little bit high. So I think a lot of people are used to, you know, the sub 1 second latencies of I go into my editor, I edit it, I write it, and then I refresh my browser or I run the script again. And we're not quite that fast on the sort of iterative cycles of containers. People are doing that, but it's more of the classic, I'm going to do the final big compile run and then test it against a dev or testing environment. So what we find a lot of people doing is they'll run the components that they know they're not going to modify, like their databases or their load balancers in containers. And then Kubernetes allows you to forward those containers to your local workstation, whether they're running on a VM on the cloud or whether they're running on a VM on your laptop or physical gear in your QA environment. They'll forward the pieces of the infrastructure they need to their laptop and then do their normal local dev experience against those testing resources and sort of develop in a way that they've been used to up until now. I think there's a lot of opportunities and technology that can be built to make that dev experience for a container as fast as the experience that people have, just the regular reload on the local file system experience, but it's not quite there yet. And the fact that engineers at CoreOS aren't using that means that we're not quite at that bar where it's easy enough or fast enough yet.
And what about adding just a file system layer so that I could add a writable layer over the top of the files and then be running from that? Is that feasible?
Yeah, that's totally feasible. And some people have been doing that on Linux hosts. So this works really well if it's like you're writing to your local file system and the container is consuming the local file system. It gets a little bit trickier when you're talking about running on a Windows workstation or a OS X workstation where there's actually going to be some sort of copy or network file system or some sort of caching layer between you and the machine that's actually running the container. And that's where the experience starts to break down. And like I said, there are people working on it. It's something that we're considering in the Minikube project. There's been some work done by the folks at Docker to make Docker for Mac work well, but it's kind of a point-by-point workstation OS by workstation OS effort. There's really no magic button that'll make this super easy. And I think it's still a work in progress.
All right, Brandon, I did have a couple of other questions. When we talked about Rocket, our chat room kind of went crazy and they wanted to know more about it. Mainly one of the questions was, is it VMware? Are you running a microkernel? As I suspect, are you actually running another CoreOS instance inside of your VM? How does that work?
Yeah, so the Rocket LKVM Stage 1, what it uses internally. So first, Rocket has this idea of stages. That's why we called it Rocket, because if you're familiar with the space industry, rockets generally have multiple stages. And one of the stages is the actual isolation. And so what we have is we have the classic Linux container isolation, which is our default stage one. And then we have the LKVM stage one. And the LKVM stage one, what it does is the previous stage sets up all the file systems, downloads the container images, verifies them optionally with cryptographic hashes, et cetera. And then what we do is we execute using LKVM, which you can think of as a even lighter weight version of the QEMU KVM tool. We launch a CoreOS Linux instance with a super modified kernel that uses some technologies called DAX, which is direct access execution, essentially making it for a really, really lightweight kernel. And we boot that very, very quickly. And then we execute your container as normal, as if it had been under the default stage one. So yes, what happens is that essentially we threw turtles all the way down technology, we execute another CoreOS instance, only with the really lightweight kernel, in order to achieve this.
So the real question is, can we put CoreOS inside a container?
Yes, that's essentially what's being done.
It really is turtles all the way down. That's great.
Exactly.
We had a question from the chat room from Gray580. How well does CoreOS handle crypto coin mining, like CPU mining? And then there was an addendum to that. Someone is interested in using different containers to mine a couple of different types of crypto coin at once.
Yeah. So CoreOS is great for these sorts of use cases where you want to be running different applications. And using containers, you can say, start to do arbitrage on your own machine. So you could say, well, looking at the markets right now, Bitcoins are doing better than Litecoin, so I'm going to dedicate more of my CPU through isolation at the container level to the Bitcoin miner, then the Litecoin miner. So you can do all sorts of interesting things. And the fact that CoreOS Linux uses the upstream kernel means that you're getting the really performant, most performant Linux kernel, hopefully, that exists. We actually have a lot of customers like International Security Exchange who use CoreOS Linux primarily because the benchmarks have been so good for them. Unlike kind of traditional operating systems, we're shipping the latest Linux kernels, and generally the latest Linux kernels are the fastest. And so if you want to get the most Bitcoins for your watt, you should definitely be using CoreOS Linux.
It's great. So what about Claire and Taurus? What are those? Why do they matter? And what are you doing with them?
Yeah, so one of the things that we do at CoreOS is we try to introduce new open source technologies that we feel solve significant problems that haven't been solved yet. And so Claire was or is the open source technology that does that security scanning of images. It comes from the French word for clear. And what we're trying to do is essentially, instead of making the images completely opaque, something that you can't understand, we try to glean metadata out of the images to do things like tell you, hey, this version of OpenSSL in this container needs to be updated. And so that technology has been integrated in a bunch of different open source projects. We've been talking to groups from the largest companies in the world all the way to hobbyists who just want to understand how these container technologies work. And that's kind of what Claire is. It's security scanning, open source security scanning for containers. Taurus is a project that we introduced a few months ago. And Taurus is a block, essentially replicated block storage. And what we're trying to solve for here is that in containers, one of the things that's really important is holding on to state. There's kind of this meme that's going around that containers are only good for 12-factor apps. When you talk to Google or you talk to any of these other large companies like Facebook and Twitter, they use containers for everything. They use containers for their stateful apps. They use them for their databases, et cetera. Now, in the open source space, we're not quite there yet. And one of the reasons we're not quite there is that managing and understanding and operating a replicated disk, so where you're actually saying when I write to disk on this machine, it's actually a copy of that is getting replicated to multiple machines in case this machine dies, is really hard. And so we built Taurus as sort of our opinion on how these replicated block systems could be put together. And it's really an early prototype of how we feel like those systems should be built. The main things is that we try to make it as quick as possible to deploy. So within a couple of minutes, you're able to get a full Kubernetes cluster up and running that you're able to run databases on, and you're able to completely destroy the machine that had been running the database, and that database will come back up in the exact same state on a new machine. And you're able to kind of deploy this complex distributed system in a few moments. And we build it on top of components that we really have confidence in, like etcd, which is that consensus data store we talked about early on. And etcd is being used in lots of really critical systems today. And we wanted to show how you could build things that are hard and important, like replicated block on top of systems like etcd. So that's what Taurus is.
So I've been playing a little bit with Docker, and I'm using, on my Mac, I'm using boot to Docker. Could CoreOS run under boot to Docker?
Yeah, so are things like CoreOS Vagrant for booting up Kubernetes, and then Minikube are very similar to that system. Minikube is really early, but our intentions with Minikube are to start to add things like CoreOS support, make it more natively integrated with your OS X machine so you can do things like write your file in your editor and refresh in your browser, and it all works through containers and that sort of thing. Cool. So there are analogous projects.
Cool. Okay. And I had said the thought earlier where you kept talking about lighter weight kernels. You know, if you make it too lightweight, does it just float away?
Yeah. So there's like a lot of things that you can think about in a kernel. So one of the most stupid and simple things about security is if you ship less stuff, it's more secure by the nature of having less surface area. And so the Coros Linux kernel, we ship essentially only stuff that you need for a server inside of it. And so our hopes are over time, and this hasn't played out so far, but our hopes over time is that container technology gets good enough that we can actually continue to shrink the Coros Linux system over time, and push more and more pieces of that system into containers. And maybe we will have the Coros Linux that's just a kernel at the end of the day.
Nice. Very cool. Well, we're almost out of time. We've got a lot of really good answers from you there today. Real nice, long answers. We like that. But is there anything we haven't asked that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we let you go?
I think the main things are just want to encourage people to try out these technologies. It can feel really daunting, but I assure you that, one, there's a very confident and competent set of communities around these technologies, and we're happy to help you out on the CoreOS mailing lists or in our IRC channel. There's a Slack channel for Kubernetes. So there's a variety of ways, however you feel comfortable engaging, to try out these technologies. And I think that they'll be a great boon for people who are building applications, running operations for these large environments and that sort of thing. So I'd encourage people to check out coreos.com/docs and really just kick the tires on this stuff. And let us know, give us your harshest feedback on what's working, and give us your greatest love on the things that you are enjoying so far about the technologies.
Very cool. Two last questions. I think I asked you that before, but I don't remember what the answers were. What's your favorite scripting language?
Go is my favorite scripting language.
All right. And your favorite editor?
I'm a hardcore Vim user.
Yep. Yeah, I think that I remember that answer from before, but it's okay. It's still cool. This is still a really cool project. It's probably worth checking again in a couple of years from now and seeing how much further it's gotten along, or if it got absorbed into some other big project, but probably not. We'll see. All right, Brandon, thanks for being on the show again.
For sure. Thanks for the time.
Great. That was Brandon Phillips, the CTO of CoreOS, or something like a three-letter title there. What did you think there, Jonathan?
Wow, very, very interesting project. I think there were three or four different things named there that we could do an entire show on.
Yep.
The idea of Rocket and being able to spin up a VM just for a container that quickly is really impressive. Clair. The Clair project, the idea that it automatically goes through and lets you know, hey, this container has something that's out of date. You really ought to go fix it. That is very, very impressive from a security standpoint.
Indeed.
And then even Taurus, the idea of a distributed block letter, or basically a distributed file system is what it sounded like. Could be very interesting and very useful for doing all sorts of things in containers. I'm curious what kind of use that has even outside of the container world. But I guess that'll be a question for a different show.
Definitely. Yeah, we keep talking, again, another half hour on this and still not be able to through all the project here. So let me tell you who's coming up. We've got Karina next week. It's an easy-to-use, instant-on native container environment. From Rackspace. This is what happened when he left. They started working on something else. Great. The show after that, the August 2nd show, has been preempted by the network. Apparently there's some big live announcement. And so don't try to tune in. And what's really great is that I've been involved every week since my cruise, and I'm very happy that that. Sorry, there's no watching the video. My light just went out. trying to get it. There we go. Oh, that's great. You got to do the video of this show. Come on, download it and check out the last few minutes. Anyway, so that show is off, just like that light was for a second. That was it. Got it. Okay, and I get to take a 2-week break, which is really nice. Shut up. Okay, after that, Cluster HQ, it's Flocker, Devol, Elliot, Machinist and Power Strip. Linux presentation day the week after that. Apparently, there's in one weekend, there'd be like dozens of places all over Europe trying to promote Linux and get people install fest, that sort of thing. LucidWorks, which is about searching your data, searching everything that you have and own. We just added two new things to the list. We've got Midokura, which is enterprise network virtualization that actually works. At least that's their tagline. Let's see how we can figure out what's from that tagline. Also just added, and when I mean just added, I mean right at the beginning of this show, I was putting this slot on, Project Atomic, which is another container OS that Red Hat's working on. I guess we're trying to see who's going to win or something. Anyway, but the best part about it is it's our friend Josh Berkus. He was my very first guest on episode 17 of Floss Weekly. And so it's been 9.5 years since we've had him on the show. Now he's working for Red Hat and is working on the next container OS. You can see all these and more at twit.tv/floss. That's the big spreadsheet. Go to from the links from there. I got a lot of people from the Red Hat Summit, including today's guest. So and Josh coming up, which is going to be great. I'm starting to open up Q4 because Q3 is almost full. We do have a live stream. We took about 5 or 6 questions from that this time. That's at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays at live.twit.tv. You can follow us on Google Plus at Floss Weekly. You can follow us on Twitter as at Floss Weekly. The Google Plus is automatically linked over to the Twitter, so if you just want the Twitter, that's cool. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Floss Weekly. If Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus, I'm just distracted today. And follow me also on Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. I am so glad conference season is over. I have no conferences to announce except DragonCon, my one guilty pleasure conference. I'm on the EFF track there talking about computers and the law and even Ingress a few times. I've talked about it there. That's coming up the Labor Day weekend in Hot Atlanta, so I won't get totally out of the heat from that. And Jonathan, what do you have to plug?
Well, I wanted to mention that I am JP_Bennett over at Twitter, but the big thing this week is we just released a beta version of the FWNOP GUI desktop app. It's got some really interesting things in the new version, and that's available at incomsystems.biz/fwnop-gui/downloads.php. So go check it out and let me know what you think.
Good deal. Well, Jonathan, thanks once again for stepping in. I mean, I think you have the record for became a brand new co-host and hosted the most shows. So thanks for helping set that record. Hopefully we'll get some other people in next week.
My pleasure.
All right, great. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.